This is Audible.
The Dangerous Book for Boys by Con and Hal Iggulden. Read by Con Iggulden and Jamie Glover.
Hello, I'm Con Iggulden. I wrote this book with my brother because we didn't have it when we were boys. In this age of video games and mobile phones, there must still be a place for Knott's treehouses and stories of incredible courage. The one thing that we always say about childhood is that we seem to have more time back then. This audiobook will help you recapture those Sunday afternoons and long summers, because they're still long if you know how to look at them. Boyhood is all about curiosity, and men and boys can enjoy stories of Scott of the Antarctic as much as they can raid a shed for the bits to make an electromagnet, or grow a crystal, build a go-kart, and learn how to find north in the dark. You'll find famous battles in this audiobook, as well as essential Shakespeare quotes, poems every boy should know, tips on how to read the stars, and wonders of the ancient world. It was written by two men who would have given away the cat to get this book when they were young. It wasn't a particularly nice cat. Why did we write it now? Because these things are important still, and we wished we knew them better. There are few things as satisfying as being able to spot the Great Bear, or simply knowing what happened at Waterloo and the Somme. The tales must be told and retold, or the memories slowly die. The stories of courage can be read as simple adventures, or perhaps as inspiration, examples of extraordinary acts by ordinary people. Since writing them, it's been a great deal harder to hop about and curse when one of us stubs a toe. If you listen to Douglas Bader's chapter, you'll see why. They're not just cracking stories. They're part of a culture, a part we really don't want to see vanish. Is it old-fashioned? Well, that depends. Men and boys today are the same as they always were, and interested in the same things. They may conquer different worlds when they grow up, but they'll still want these stories for themselves and for their sons. We hope in years to come that this will be a book to dig out of the attic and give to a couple of kids staring at a pile of wood and wondering what to do with it. When you're a man, you realize that everything changes. But when you're a boy, you know different. The camp you make today will be there forever. You want to be self-sufficient and find your way by the stars. Perhaps for those who come after us, you want to reach them. Well, why not? Why not?
The Seven Wonders of the Ancient World. The famous Seven Wonders of the Ancient World were the Great Pyramid of Cheops at Giza, the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, the Temple of Artemis at Ephesus, the Mausoleum at Halicarnassus, the Colossus of Rhodes, the Statue of Zeus at Olympia, and the Pharos Lighthouse at Alexandria. Only the Pyramid at Giza survives to the modern day. The Great Pyramid is the largest tomb ever built, created for the 4th Dynasty Egyptian pharaoh Khufu, 2898 to 2875 BC, though he is better known by the Greek form of his name, Cheops. It is one of the three great pyramids at Giza near Cairo, the other two being constructed for the pharaohs Menkaure and Khafre. The largest, for Cheops, was the tallest structure on earth for more than 4,000 years, until the 19th century AD. Though the capstone was removed at some point, it would have stood at 481 feet, or 146.5 meters high. The base is perfectly square, a feat of astonishing accuracy, considering the sheer size of it. Each side of the base is 755 feet 8 inches, or 231 meters long, and each side slopes at 51 degrees 51 minutes. It is composed of 2 million blocks of stone, each one weighing more than 2 tons. They fit together so well that not even a knife blade can be slid between them. The Hanging Gardens of Babylon were built in what is now modern-day Iraq, on the banks of the river Euphrates. They were created by King Nebuchadnezzar for his queen between the 7th and 6th centuries BC. Famously, they employed complex hydraulic systems to raise thousands of gallons from the river and keep the gardens blooming. We can only guess at the exact method, but an Archimedean screw may have been employed. The Temple of Artemis, Diana, at Ephesus, in what is now modern-day Turkey, is said to have awed Alexander the Great with its extraordinary beauty, though the citizens refused his offer to bear the cost of a restoration. Originally built in the 6th century BC, the temple was destroyed and rebuilt on more than one occasion, though the most famous was the night of Alexander's birth, when a man named Herostratus burned it so that his name would be remembered, one of the greatest acts of vandalism of all time. It finally fell into ruin around the 3rd century AD. The mausoleum at Halicarnassus was created for King Mausolus of Persia, who ruled from 377 to 353 BC. Halicarnassus is now the city of Bodrum in Turkey. On top of the rectangular tomb chamber, 36 columns supported a stepped pyramid crowned by statues of Mausolus and his wife and sister, Artemisia, in a chariot, reaching a height of approximately 140 feet, or 42.5 meters. It was destroyed in 1522, when crusading knights of St. John used the stone to build a castle that still stands today. The polished marble blocks of the tomb are visible in the walls. From Mausolus, we have the word mausoleum, meaning an ornate tomb. The statue of Zeus at Olympia is also lost to the modern world. Only images on coins and descriptions survive to tell us why the statue was considered so astonishing in the 5th century BC. Olympia was the site of the ancient Olympic Games, giving us the word. The site was sacred to Zeus, and Phidias of Athens was commissioned to carve the statue. The statue was of wood, lead, and gold for the cloth, and ivory sheets for the flesh. In his right hand stood the winged figure of the goddess Victory, Nike, made of ivory and gold. In his left, he held a scepter made of gold with an eagle perched on the end. The Roman emperor Caligula tried to transfer the statue to Rome in the 1st century AD, but the scaffolding collapsed under the weight, and the attempt was abandoned. Later on, the statue was moved to Constantinople and remained there until it was destroyed by fire in the 5th century. The Colossus of Rhodes in Greece is perhaps the most famous of the 7 ancient wonders. It was a statue of Helios, over 100 feet or 30 meters high. It did not actually stand across the harbour, but instead rested on a promontory, looking out over the Aegean Sea. The base was white marble, and the statue was built slowly upwards, strengthened with iron and stone as the bronze pieces were added. It took 12 years, and was finished around 280 BC, quickly becoming famous. An earthquake proved disastrous for the statue 50 years later. It broke at the knee and crashed to the earth to lie there for 800 years before invading Arabs sold it. The Pharos Lighthouse at Alexandria was built by the architect Sostratus of Cnidus for the Greco-Egyptian king Ptolemy Philadelphus, 285 to 247 BC. Ptolemy's ancestor had been one of Alexander the Great's generals. His most famous descendant is Cleopatra, who was the first of her Greek line actually to speak Egyptian. When Julius Caesar arrived in Alexandria, he would have passed by the great lighthouse on Pharos Island. Its light was said to be visible for 35 miles, or 55 kilometers, out to sea. Its exact height is unknown, but to have shed visible light to that distance, it must have been between 400 and 600 feet high, or 121 to 182 meters. It was so famous that even today the word for lighthouse in Spanish and Italian is faro. French also uses the same root, with phare. As you can see, even the greatest wonders can be lost or broken by the passage of millennia. Perhaps the true wonder is the fact that we build them, reaching always for something greater than ourselves. Extraordinary stories. Stories of courage and determination are sometimes underrated for their ability to inspire. It is true that one's famous names can slip from the memory of generations. Names like Charles George Gordon, Richard Francis Burton, Florence Nightingale, Robert Scott, Herbert Kitchener, Henry Morton Stanley, Rudyard Kipling, Isambard Kingdom Brunel, and a host of others. Their lives, their stories, were once known to every schoolboy, held up as examples of fortitude and honour. These values have not ceased to be important in the modern world, nor have the stories become less moving. These are all tales worth knowing. Douglas Bader. Rules are for the obedience of fools and the guidance of wise men. Douglas Robert Bader was born on the 10th of February 1910 in London. His father, Frederick, was a civil engineer, and when Douglas was just a few months old, he and his wife, Jessie, went out to work in India. They considered the climate too harsh for a baby, and Douglas did not join them until he was two. The Bader family came back to England in 1913, though with the outbreak of World War I, Frederick Bader went with the army to France. Douglas never saw his father again. He died there after complications with a shrapnel wound. His mother, Jessie, remarried, but Douglas spent a great deal of time with his aunt Hazel Bader and her husband, Flight Lieutenant Cyril Burge, who was adjutant to the RAF College at Cramwell. Through that relationship, Bader discovered a love of planes and flying that would last him the rest of his life. He had been a superb sportsman at St. Edward's School in Oxford, and after becoming a cadet at Cramwell in 1928, he represented the college at boxing, cricket, hockey, and rugby. His academic studies were not as impressive, and he came second for the Sword of Honour at graduation. One of the students said, "To us, Bader was a sort of god who played every conceivable game and was the best player in every team." He was commissioned as an RAF officer in 1930. He was an extremely gifted pilot, and gained a place in his squadron aerobatics team, winning the pairs title at the Hendon Pageant of 1931. He was absolutely without fear, and pushed his biplane a little too far on the 14th of December that year. He was showing off to friends with low rolls barely above the ground. One wingtip touched, and the plane crashed, doing terrible damage to his legs. Dr. Leonard Joyce had to amputate his right leg above the knee, his left below. The 21-year-old Bader was not expected to survive, but he had a fierce will to live and a furious temper. He began the slow, painful path to recovery and was transferred to the RAF hospital at Uxbridge. He met the great love of his life, Thelma Edwards, there, and married her in 1935. Bader was given metal artificial legs and had to learn to use them, as well as grow calluses on his stumps. The right leg was particularly tricky, as the metal knee joint required great balance and perseverance. He was told he should use the sticks to help his progress, as he would never walk without them. Bader replied, "On the contrary, I will never bloody walk with them." He never did, relying instead on his reflexes, coordination, and sheer will. His life had altered forever. Later, Bader recorded the event in his flying log with these words: "Ex-country Reading. Crashed, slow rolling near ground. Bad show." After being discharged from the RAF, Bader went to work for the Asiatic Petroleum Company. As he couldn't fly, he drove a specially adapted sports car like a maniac along country lanes. But there was more to come in the life of this extraordinary man. When the Second World War broke out in 1939, Douglas immediately attempted to re-enlist. He was refused at first, being told that there was nothing in the King's regulations allowing a man in his condition to fly. He retorted that there was nothing in the King's regulations to say a man in his condition couldn't fly. He had the support of his fellow officers, especially those who had known him from before the accident. Britain needed pilots, and Bader was taken back into the RAF and made flight commander of 222 Squadron, flying and making his first kill as they covered the retreat at Dunkirk. He was promoted after that action to command the Canadian 242 Squadron. They had lost half their number in casualties and were severely demoralized. With his metal legs, they assumed at first that he would lead them from behind a desk, but instead, he demonstrated aerobatics to them for an hour, flying a Hurricane fighter. Douglas Bader was the right man to restore their morale through his peculiar brand of stubbornness and charismatic leadership. From the beginning, he trained them in his own style of fighting, ignoring the fighter command official tactics. In fact, His ideas would prove their usefulness and became effective tactics for the RAF in resisting the German bombers and fighter escorts. Under Baader, 242 Squadron first fought in the Battle of Britain on the 30th of August 1940 against the German fighter waves, taking down 12 German planes in a single hour. They would go on to fly 3 or 4 sorties a day for as long as their Hurricanes would stand up to the punishment. Baader himself was responsible for 22.5 air-to-air victories, the half after he and a friend shot up a German plane together, and both agreed to claim half the kill. The total made him the 5th highest ace in the RAF. The importance of this cannot be overestimated. Without air superiority, Britain could not have defended her cities or airfields in World War II. German bombers would have had a free hand as they had over in Europe. Baader was awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross, DFC, and the Distinguished Service Order, DSO, for gallantry and leadership at the Battle of Britain. In the lull after the battle, Baader continued to take his squadron out to attack German E-boats and the occasional lone Dornier bomber. He was a key player in the revision of RAF and US Air Force tactics, commanding the Tangmere wing of 3 squadrons as they prowled over the Channel looking for the enemy. When returning from successful missions, Baader was in the habit of opening his cockpit canopy and lighting a pipe with a control stick held between his metal knee and his good knee. When other pilots saw him do this, they kept a good distance in case he blew the plane up with petrol fumes. In 1941, he was involved in a mid-air collision over France with a German ME-109 whilst dogfighting. The tail of Baader's plane was torn off, and he began plummeting towards the ground. He got the canopy off and climbed out into the wind to parachute clear. His right leg caught, and he found himself nailed to the fuselage by the slipstream, heaving and tugging at the metal leg before it took him down with the plane. At last, the belt holding the leg to him snapped, and the leg went off through his trousers, allowing him to break free of the plane and parachute to safety. In German captivity, he asked if a message could be sent to England for his spare right leg to be sent over. It is an astonishing thing, but the Germans agreed to this, and the RAF dropped it in a crate during a normal bombing run. The leg was slightly damaged on the landing, but the Germans repaired it and took it to Baader in the hospital where he was being held. He put it on, and while no one was paying attention, walked casually out of the hospital in an attempt to escape. They caught him, but he maintained this spirit of cheerful defiance in various prisoner of war camps, inspiring respect from those around him. All British prisoners understood that escape attempts meant that more guards would be used who might otherwise be killing Allied forces. Even failed attempts had value. Eventually, the Germans sent Baader to the famous Colditz Castle, which was meant to be escape-proof. More than 300 attempts were made over 5 years, and 31 people did, in fact, get completely clear. The inmates built a complete glider, walked out dressed as German soldiers, and generally forced the Germans to use vast resources and manpower to keep them in. Airy Neave was the first Briton to escape the castle. He later went on to become an MP, and was killed in an IRA car bomb in 1979. Baader attempted escape so many times that the Germans took his legs away. A great outcry was raised over this, and the Germans were shamed into returning them. Baader promptly escaped again, and had to be brought back. He was still there when the Americans liberated Colditz in 1945, and he returned to England where he was promoted to group captain. With the war over, he couldn't see a future for himself in a peacetime RAF, and instead joined Shell Oil's aviation department, a job that came with its own plane. Baader raised money and campaigned for disabled people, flying all over the world visiting veterans' hospitals. He inspired others by his example and his willpower. One day in 1955, he went back to speak at his old school in Oxford. A 15-year-old pupil saw Group Captain Baader coming through the gates with his instantly recognizable gait. Baader was carrying cases, and it was a hot day, so the boy ran across and offered to help with the bags. Baader's response was to tell him to bugger off in a very angry tone. The headmaster came to see the boy later. He said that he had done the right thing in offering, but Group Captain Baader will not be helped. He regards carrying his own cases on a blazing hot day as a challenge. The book and film Reach for the Sky tell the man's story better than we have here. Bader was always a prickly, difficult personality, but his courage and stubbornness were legendary. He died in 1982, but his story is still an inspiration. Famous battles. In the main, history springs from both noble and petty sources, from jealousy and murder as much as the dreams of great men and women. As well as being formed in new laws and sweeping cultural movements, history is made on the battlefield, with entire futures hanging on the outcome. You will find further study of these examples both enlightening and rewarding. Each is an extraordinary story in itself. Each had repercussions that helped to change the world. Hastings, 14th of October, 1066. This is one of the most famous dates in English history, the last successful invasion up to modern times. At first, after the Romans left, Britain was almost constantly invaded. At first, the Saxons proved bothersome. Then, just as everyone was settling down to being Anglo-Saxon, the Vikings arrived. The Danish king, Canute, created a small, stable empire early in the 11th century, ruling England, Norway, Sweden, and Denmark. He had taken the English throne from Ethelred the Unready, and after Canute's death, his feckless sons lost it back to Ethelred's son, Edward, known as the Confessor, for his piety. He named Harold Godwinson as his heir, crowned King Harold in January 1066, the last Anglo-Saxon king before the Normans arrived, and spoiled it for everyone. In fact, William of Normandy had probably been named heir by Edward the Confessor as far back as 1051. William had also extracted a promise from Harold Godwinson to support that claim when Harold was shipwrecked off Normandy in 1064. In that sense, the 1066 landing was to protect his rightful throne, though that isn't the usual view. We don't know the exact size of his army, and estimates vary enormously. It was probably around 12,000 cavalry and 20,000 infantry. In September, Harold was busy repulsing Norwegian invasions. They'd promised Harold's brother, Tostig, an earldom for his aid. Harold marched north from London to relieve York from a Norse army. He met them at Stamford Bridge on the 25th of September, fighting for many hours. Of the 300 ships the Norwegians had brought over, only 24 were needed for the survivors. Tostig was killed. Stamford Bridge resulted in heavy casualties amongst Harold's best soldiers, which was to prove of vital importance to the later battle at Hastings. On the 28th of September, William of Normandy landed on the Sussex coast. Harold heard of the landing by the 2nd of October, and immediately marched 200 miles south, which his army covered in less than 5 days. That is 40 miles a day with weapons and armour. Harold rested his men in London from the 6th to the 11th of October, then marched to Hastings, covering 56 miles in 48 hours. Again, we have only estimates of the size of his army, but it is believed to have been around 9,000 men. He was badly outnumbered, and only a third of his men were first-rate troops. Still, it is difficult to see what else he could have done. Harold took position on Senlac Ridge, about 8 miles northwest of Hastings. On the 14th of October, the Norman army advanced in three lines, archers, pikemen, and cavalry. William's archers fired first at too long a range, then fell back through their own lines to allow the pikemen to reach the enemy. The second line stormed forward, but were battered back from the ridge by rocks, spears, and furious hand-to-hand fighting. William then led a charge up the ridge, but it too failed to penetrate. The Normans' left wing fell back, and Harold's soldiers rushed forward to take advantage of their weakness. Harold's army was set to crush the invaders, as a rumour went round that William had fallen. William threw off his helmet and rode up and down his lines to let his men see he was alive. As well as being a splendid moment, his action does show the importance of charismatic leadership at this time, a tradition going back to Thermopylae and beyond. When they saw William, the Normans rallied and crushed their pursuers. Seeing how their strategy had worked to his advantage, William used the technique again. He staged a false cavalry panic and succeeded in drawing more of Harold's men from their position, his cavalry returning to cut them down. Yet most of Harold's men remained on the ridge and the battle was far from over. Many assaults by infantry, archers and cavalry followed. Harold's forces were exhausted by mid-afternoon, but their courage had not faltered, and they had sent back every attack against them. At that point, a chance arrow struck Harold in the eye, wounding him mortally. Morale plummeted, and the English lines began to fail. In terms of historical effect, this battle was the seed that would flower into the largest empire the world has ever known. Countries like Germany, Belgium, and Italy have only existed as nation-states in the last couple of centuries, but England has maintained her identity through 1,000 years. On Christmas Day, 1066, in Westminster Abbey, William I was crowned King of England. Waterloo, 18th of June, 1815. Napoleon had overreached himself by 1814. He had lost more than 350,000 men in his march on Russia, one of the most ill-advised military actions in history. Wellington had beaten his armies and their Spanish allies in Spain. In addition, the armies of Austria and Prussia stood ready to humble him at last. Yet Napoleon was not a man to go quietly into obscurity. When he abdicated as emperor, he was exiled to rule the tiny island of Elba, off the west coast of Italy. Perhaps cruelly, he was allowed to keep the title he claimed for himself. Many lives would have been saved if he and his honour guard had stayed there. Instead, 11 months after his arrival, a frigate picked him up and he returned to France. The French king, Louis XVIII, sent troops with orders to fire on him. Famously, Napoleon walked fearlessly out to them, threw open his coat and said, "Let him that has the heart kill his emperor." The soldiers cheered him, and Napoleon turned them round and marched on Paris. By the 20th of March, 1815, the French king had fled, and Napoleon was back. The period of March to June is still known as the Hundred Days' War. With extraordinary efficiency, Napoleon put together an army of 188,000 regulars, 300,000 levies, or conscripts, and another 100,000 support personnel. In addition, he had his veteran army of the north around Paris, 124,000 men. Wellington's Anglo-Dutch army of 95,000 was in Flanders, or Belgium at this point, with a Prussian army of 124,000 under Marshal Blücher. The Austrians had 210,000 men along the Rhine, and another army of 75,000 in Italy. The Russian army of 167,000 under Barclay were coming through Germany to attack France. In many ways, Napoleon had overreached himself in 1815 as well. Napoleon moved quickly against the armies in Belgium, attempting to crush his enemies one or two at a time. Unfortunately for his hopes, Wellington's forces stopped one of his marshals at Quatre Bras, south of Brussels, counterattacking and preventing the support Napoleon needed to destroy the Prussians. Blücher's men did take terrible casualties when they met Napoleon at Ligny, but were still able to retreat in good order. Napoleon did not follow up his advantage, and Wellington was able to move from Quatre Bras to a better position, ready for battle. He chose a ridge named Mont Saint-Jean to the south of the village of Waterloo. It was the evening of the 17th of June, and that night it rained in torrents. Blücher had given his word to Wellington that he would reinforce the British position. His deputy, Genisenau, was convinced Wellington would fail to hold the ridge and would be gone by the time the Prussians arrived. He wanted to abandon their allies and return to Prussia. Despite exhaustion and being wounded himself, the 72-year-old Blücher overrode him and gave orders for his men to support Wellington. It is an interesting detail that Genisenau arranged the Prussian marching order so that the units furthest away from Wellington would go first. It seems he knew this would delay their arrival. The furthest unit, however, was General von Bülow's 4th Corps, one of the best units the Prussians had. The eventual arrival of the Prussians would force Napoleon to respond, just as he should have been attacking the British centre. This was a vital part of the victory. The ground was a quagmire after the downpour of the night before, and Napoleon delayed the attack until it began to dry. On noon of the 18th of June, he attacked at last with 72,000 against Wellington's 67,000. Napoleon's troops moved forward in a faint attack, while his belles filles, or beautiful daughters, guns hammered at Wellington's army for an hour. At 1 p.m, 20,000 veterans moved in line formation towards the British-held ridge. They too had to march through artillery fire, and the carnage was horrific. Yet two of the veteran divisions made it to the crest through fierce hand-to-hand fighting. This was a crucial point in the battle, but it was saved by the Household Brigade and Union Brigade cavalry under the Earl of Uxbridge, who smashed the French attackers with a charge over the ridge. The two brigades continued on across the valley, attacking the French guns. They took about 20, and most of them were exhausted as they were broken in turn by the French cavalry reserves. The damage was done, however. The only truly formidable French infantry left on the field were his Imperial Guard, his elite. There were some confused orders in the French lines at this point. Wellington ordered his men to pull back 100 feet out of range of the French guns. Marshal Ney thought they were retreating and ordered a brigade of French cavalry to attack. His order was queried, and in an angry response, Ney led them himself, taking around 4,000 cavalrymen forward without support. If Napoleon had sent in his Imperial Guard at this point, Wellington could well have lost the battle. Napoleon had become aware of the approach of the Prussians and refused to commit them. Unsupported, the cavalry failed to damage the British square formations in any significant way. Volley fire repulsed them, and the survivors eventually retreated. The heavy French cannons opened up again, and more on the ridge began to die. By 4 in the afternoon, the Prussians were there in force, led by the 4th Corps. They took a strategic position on Napoleon's right flank, and had to be dislodged by vital troops from the Imperial Young and Old Guard regiments. By the time that was done, it was getting on for 7 in the evening. So close to midsummer, the days were long and it was still light when Napoleon sent in his Imperial Guard at last to break the British centre. They wore dark blue jackets and wore high bearskin hats. In all their history, they had never retreated. The Imperial Guard marched up the hill towards a brigade of British foot guards under Colonel Maitland and a Dutch brigade under Colonel Detmer. Volley fire and a bayonet charge made the Imperial Guard retreat. Wellington sent in more men after them as they tried to reform, and they were finished. The British Guard regiments were well aware of the reputation of the Napoleonic elite and took their hats as souvenirs. The high bearskin headgear is still worn today by the Grenadier, Welsh, Irish, Scots, and Coldstream Guard regiments. Blücher attacked the French right as Wellington counterattacked it in force. The French army collapsed. Afterwards, Blücher wanted to call the battle La Belle Alliance, but Wellington insisted on his old habit of naming battles after the place where he'd spent the night before. As a result, it became known as the Battle of Waterloo. Napoleon returned to Paris and abdicated for the second time on the 22nd of June before surrendering to the British. He was taken on board HMS Bellerophon, one of the ships that had fought at the Nile and Trafalgar with Nelson. Ironically, Bellerophon, known as Billy Ruffian, was one of those that had fired on Napoleon's flagship, L'Orient, before she exploded at the Battle of the Nile. Napoleon was taken to the island of St. Helena and would not leave it until his death. Waterloo was Wellington's last battle, though he did become Prime Minister in 1828. Blücher died in his bed at home in 1819. France was forced to pay damages to Britain, Austria, Prussia, and Russia. Those countries met in Vienna to settle the future of Europe. A neutral country, or buffer zone, was created from those talks, its peace guaranteed by the others. It was later known as Belgium, when it became completely independent in 1830. Interestingly, it is true that the Wellington boot takes its name from a leather boot style popularized by Wellington. Originally, it was made of leather, and only later produced in the rubber form we know so well today. The Somme, 1st of July, 1916. One of the many and complex reasons that World War I began was that Germany invaded Belgium. Britain was bound by treaty to defend the country. Similar alliances across Europe drew in all the great powers one by one. It may have begun with the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand in Serbia, but that was merely the spark that set the world on fire. The Somme was the river in France that Edward III crossed just before the Battle of Crecy. The area has had a great deal of British blood soaking into its earth over the centuries, but never more so than on the first day of the Battle of the Somme, the 1st of July, 1916. Before the British Army marched into the machine gun tracks criss-crossing the battlefield, General Sir Douglas Haig had ordered 8 days of artillery bombardment. This had not proved a successful tactic over the previous 2 years, and it did not on that day. One flaw was that the barrage had to stop to allow the Allies to advance, so as soon as it stopped, the Germans knew the attack was coming and made their preparations. They had solid, deep bunkers of concrete and wood that resisted the barrage very well indeed. Their barbed wire emplacements were also still intact after the shells stopped. At 7:28 in the morning, the British forces detonated 2 huge mines, then 3 smaller ones near German lines. The idea was probably to intimidate the enemy, but instead they acted as a final confirmation of the attack. The slaughter began at 7:30, when the British soldiers rose up out of their trenches and tried to cross 800 yards in the face of machine gun fire. A few actually made it to the German front line in that first surge before they were cut down. There were 60,000 British casualties and 19,000 dead. An entire generation fell on a single morning, making it the worst disaster of British military history. Who can say what their lives would have meant and achieved had they survived? There is a touching poem called For the Fallen, written by Lawrence Binyon in 1914, that is quoted at every Remembrance Day service. This is an extract from it, remembering those who gave their lives for their country. The second verse is particularly poignant. They went with songs to the battle. They were young, straight of limb, true of eye, steady and aglow. They were staunch to the end against odds uncounted. They fell with their faces to the foe. They shall grow not old, as we that are left grow old. Age shall not weary them, nor the years condemn. At the going down of the sun and in the morning, we will remember them. The Patron Saints of Britain. The United Kingdom is made up of 4 main countries. England, Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland. The Union flag was first created in 1606. It is a combination of the Cross of St. Andrew for Scotland, the Cross of St. George for England, and the Cross of St. Patrick for Ireland. Wales was joined with England in 1536 as a principality rather than a separate kingdom, and is therefore also represented by the Cross of St. George. St. George, the 23rd of April. The story of the patron saint of England slaying a monstrous dragon is known by all schoolchildren, but whether he existed at all and how he became the English patron saint is still a bit of a mystery. One light-hearted story suggests that St. George made a huge fortune selling bacon to the Roman army, and that's why the English, a nation of shopkeepers, adopted him as a saint. The man who was canonized as St. George was a Roman soldier who served in England. One of the few solid facts around this enigmatic man is that he was killed in AD 303, during the persecution of Christians by the Emperor Diocletian. The Archbishop of Genoa compiled a collection of the lives of the saints and tells us that after St. George had slain the dragon, he gave up his knightly wealth and preached about Jesus Christ until he saw Diocletian's cruelty. He scolded the emperor and was tortured and beheaded for speaking out. Edward the Confessor was the patron saint of England until the Plantagenets adopted St. George in 1348. The Order of the Garter was created by Edward III. He and his son, also Edward, known as the Black Prince, were the first members of what is one of the world's oldest surviving orders of chivalry. A gold collar is part of the insignia, carrying a representation of